Welcome to Hedge Fund Tips with Tom Hayes. I'm Tom Hayes, and this is your 185th video cast, 175th podcast for the week ending May 4th, 2023. A ton to go through today, but I wanted to kick it off quickly. First off, this is a picture of us at the girls' swim team award ceremony at the Rock Rimmon Country Club in Stamford, Connecticut this weekend, and they had a talent show and it was a lot of fun. So you can see they're getting big here. The other thing I wanted to cover quickly is yesterday, Charlie Gasparino out of Fox Business put out this scoop. It said senior banking execs tell Fox Business they believe Secretary Yellen and FDIC are moving toward either an explicit or de facto guarantee of deposits above the 250,000 limit to stem the regional banking crisis now threatening a new set of mid-sized institutions developing. We've been saying this for 6 months. Now, I retweeted this 17 hours ago. Nothing has happened. This morning, it's now 12:21. About 30 minutes ago, 40 minutes ago, we bought a bunch of KRE long-dated call options. If this is turns out to be true, which my guess is it would happen over the weekend, so there could be some weakness before then for sure, but or it could happen not at all. This could be incorrect or they could change their mind or whatever. This would be the, quote, mother of all short squeezes. So we want to have a little participation in that. Nothing crazy, but some deep in the money long dated premium, because I think this is just getting completely washed out and it's going to force their hand. They didn't do it by proactively by actually thinking through a few chess moves, which we talked about 6 weeks ago, but they'll wind up doing it reactively like everything else. So we'll see if this scoop turns out to be accurate and what timeline. It could take them weeks and, you know, by then the thing could be 50% lower, but more likely than not, I think we're getting to the point of acute pain and maybe we see something over the weekend. And here we are just after noon on Thursday as we record this because we got to jump on a plane to San Diego tonight. Want to thank Zhao Da Silva and Karishma Vaswani. Zhao is also Portuguese. Many of you know I'm 50% Portuguese on my mother's side. She came from Portugal. And so he put me on the BBC on Sunday night with Karishma Vaswani. We're going to listen to that because it was actually somewhat prescient as to what took place this week. Not only what took place with the receivership of First Republic, but also why it happened, why it's going to keep happening until they do something along the lines of what Charlie's talking about and some other things I talk about with the Fed. Take a listen now.
We're seeing reports that a deal to rescue the First Republic Bank is imminent. U.S. regulators have reportedly asked six banks to bid for the embattled lender. Shares in First Republic plunged last week, you might recall, after it admitted that customers had withdrawn $100 billion in deposits in March. Now, at that time, its competitor Silicon Valley Bank had collapsed, prompting fears of a wider banking crisis. SVB's failure was swiftly followed by the demise of another U.S. lender, Signature Bank. Well, for more on this and whether a takeover of First Republic could put an end to the crisis in the banking sector, we can speak with the chairman of Great Hill Capital, Thomas Hayes, who joins me now from New York. Great to get you on the program, Thomas. So in the first instance, what do you make of these latest developments?
Well, we're going to see what happens tonight. Either they're going to get a deal done. I know Citizens and JP Morgan and PNC were invited to bid. USB and Bank of America declined the opportunity to bid. The odds are on a receivership and then a bid for the assets. If they do a deal, it will be at a very small level. They've lost $22 billion of market cap. But I think to your earlier point, Karishma, when you see one bank fail, like Silicon Valley Bank, then you could say, well, it was management. They didn't hedge out their interest rate risk. But then you saw Signature Bank. You saw Silvergate Capital. Now you're seeing First Republic. And it all points to one common denominator. And the Fed has moved too aggressively, too quickly, the steepest hiking cycle in 40 years. And things are starting to break. So they're going to have to ease off. And this comes at the perfect time, considering that we have the Fed meeting on Wednesday.
So, you know, when you make that point, of course, the fact that it you are seeing this spillover, right, Thomas, in the wider banking sector. How concerned are you about the health of other U.S. banks against this backdrop?
Well, you have 46% of deposits in the United States that are still uninsured. And the thing that would seal this up right away is if the executive branch, which has the ability to do so in times of emergency, would step in and say, we're going to do a temporary backstop on all deposits for the next 24 months until Congress can get together and increase the FDIC insurance, maybe from $250,000 to $500,000. That would probably quell the some of the problems. The banks in general, certainly the larger banks, are very well capitalized. This is nothing like 2008, so there's no worries on that front. However, Chair Powell has referenced his affinity for Paul Volcker many times, and he wants to break the back of inflation like his hero. The problem is if you look at the history of what Volcker actually did, is Volcker stopped hiking rates and even started cutting rates in 1982 while inflation was still above 6%. So why did Volcker do that with inflation still so high? Is because he understood the lagged effect of an aggressive tightening policy that he did in previous months. And Powell really needs to come to that conclusion, even though inflation hasn't met his targets, that he can pause, assess the data over the next few months. If he needs to go back to hiking, he can do so. But I think when you're seeing things start to break, it's time to pause. If he were to pause, I think you'd see a big settling in the banking system.
I just want to jump in there, and not that I'm trying to defend Chair Powell or anything, but you know, can we blame all of this on higher interest rates, Thomas? Isn't this also down to the fact that regulation isn't as tight as it could be in the United States? And that's been an issue for the banking sector as well.
Yeah, I certainly wouldn't blame it on the loosening of policy that you saw in recent years. That was not impactful as it relates to these four. Now, was the supervision a little bit lax in San Francisco? Yes. Was it a little bit lax in Signature Bank? Yes. But there were warning signs. This is a symptom of the steepest hiking cycle within the last 40 years. And you just can't. You know, the problem is you got all these deposits from all of the stimulus during the pandemic. You got them all at once at the exact worst time to reinvest them when rates were effectively zero. And these banks did not do any cowboy type of investments. They weren't reaching for crazy thing. You know, if you look at Silicon Valley Bank, they had 5.7-year duration in U.S. treasuries. So they forced all these deposits through the stimulus checks into the banks. The banks had to invest them. Maybe they could have been a slightly lower duration, but they had to make some income. So this is, it's kind of, you know, it's right. It's the unintended consequence of a plan to obviously get a hold of inflation. But inflation has been coming down since last July, and it's time to let it work through the system.
Thomas Hayes there, chairman of Great Hill Capital. Great to get you on the show.
And we're back. The second one I want to get to is with David Lynn, the David Lynn Report. And I got to say, I do a decent amount of media for those of you who have followed me for a while. But there are two shows that tend to get abnormally high engagement and feedback. One is Money Mitch over at Bingzinga. He doesn't have a midday show anymore, but I think he's working on a new one. So we'll look forward to getting back on that once he gets that going. But also David Lynn, he came from Kitco. So he has a huge following of people who are into gold and Bitcoin and that type of stuff. And these are very, very passionate, engaged people. And whenever I do an interview with him, it just gets, I think he got like 60,000 or 65,000 views on it. And a lot of great engagement. So you should check out his website. Just go to YouTube and put in the David Lynn Report. It'll come up there. Or if you, actually, it's right here. If you click on here on the website, you'll see it. We're going to listen to this one because it not only goes into the Fed stuff, but we also go through some of our current picks. I know there's a lot of anxiety about China right now. We're going to walk through that this week. But take a listen. For now, credit conditions have tightened. The labor market has loosened. GDP has come down, you know, which no one was really positioned for. And you've got some more dovish members now with Goolsbee talking some sense after the Fed has basically rammed the truck through the wall and started to break things. You have some voices of reason coming on board and saying, hold on. Let's just take a breather here and see how this works on a lag basis before we absolutely throw the economy off the cliff, which it could be teetering on if they keep pressing.
Stock markets are rebounding on Thursday on the back of strong earnings releases from tech companies, but GDP came in lower today and another gray cloud looms. So what does this all mean for markets going forward, and how should investors be positioned right now? Joining me to discuss these issues is Thomas Hayes, managing member of Great Hill Capital. Welcome, Thomas, to my show. Pleasure to have you today on the David Lynn Report.
Thanks for having me, David. Glad to be back.
So this big cloud I was talking about, let's talk about it first. First Republic Bank, stocks continue to sink lower. And the question is whether or not it's going to get bought out. It hasn't found a buyer yet, or it's going to get absorbed by the government. What do you think is going to happen next?
Well, it's basically sitting in the fetal position like a wounded duck, and no one wants to pull the trigger. I think what you basically have here is a bank with a ton of uninsured deposits. They had very chunky, ultra high net worth deposits, which knew once they smelled a little bit of whiff of trouble, they all fleed immediately. And it's going to be very difficult to find a buyer because the buyer will have to raise a lot of equity capital against the underwater assets. So I think the most likely scenario, David, is that we're going to see a forced marriage backstopped by the government. Like you saw with Credit Suisse and UBS, where the government will have to come in with taxpayer dollars to backstop it and make it worth the larger bank's while. Barring that, more likely than not, it goes into receivership. But this has been a big overhang on the market. So, you know, we've had really blowout, fantastic earnings, especially just this week with tech, well better than feared, well better than expected. And I think that's kind of put the market at ease. And you really just have this overhang because the longer it sits, lingers out there, the higher the chance of contagion and the higher likelihood that the Fed will ultimately have to come in, believe it or not, and either temporarily or permanently backstop all deposits. So they need to get this wrapped up potentially over the weekend, more likely than not, either take it into receivership and call it a day, or do a forced marriage and backstop it with some government guarantees and on to the next so we can move past this. Because when you look at the other ones that I continue to keep on my dashboard just to give me a sense of where the market's going, Pacific West Bancorp is doing well. Their deposits actually went up. Western Alliance is doing well. So all the ones that were at risk on the West Coast seem to have weathered the storm much better than First Republic. And that has to do with the lumpy deposits, which was a similar situation with SVP.
But the remaining deposits at FRC aren't at risk?
Well, it depends. It's according to Warren Buffett, who's not going to actually be the one to step in and backstop it. I would say more likely than not, the government would backstop them as an implicit guarantee. But, you know, if I had uninsured deposits there, I would probably be spreading them out a little bit and taking a little bit of precaution because the FDIC insurance right now is 250. I think that is too low. I do think that the executive branch has the ability to act unilaterally in times of crisis, despite everyone saying it'll take too long to work through Congress. And they could do a 24-month backstop until they could get the formal limits increased through Congress. And that would solve the vast majority of the problem. But to date, we still have 45% of deposits in this country that are uninsured. So you have seen money flee into the systemically important banks, which are Bank of America, Wells Fargo, Citi, JP Morgan, et cetera. And you've also seen a ton of money move into money markets because particularly treasury-backed money markets and in some case, commercial paper money markets as well. So that's the state of affairs. But, you know, this hanging out in purgatory helps no one. And I think the Fed needs to take some action here.
All right. So let's finish up talking about the banks. We'll move on to earnings and your market outlook. So you mentioned that the Federal Reserve may put a surprise pause on rate hikes next week due to a number of potentially unforeseen factors. What could they be?
Well, I think that you have this banking crisis still alive. I mean, we're 4, 5, 6 weeks into this, and we still have no resolution. So you're seeing a contraction in lending to businesses on the commercial side. So you're seeing a tightening of credit the longer that this drags on. You are seeing some deposit flight in regional banks continuing to a greater or lesser extent, depending on the banks. and lending, and a lot of fear about obviously commercial real estate, because if you think about these regional banks, what are they? They're in B and C property regions, not A property regions. Not all REITs are created equal, but the commercial real estate that is in the B or C, I would liken it to the mall crisis of 4 to 5 years ago. If you remember, everyone said there were going to be all these ghost malls and the B and C properties were going to be toast. And they were absolutely right. The B and C malls were toast. But the A malls did even better than ever. If you think about Simon Property Group, they have the Apple stores, they have the Lululemon stores, the upscale malls did great. I think the same is going to be the case with commercial property and particularly office property. You saw Boston Properties beat this week, top line and bottom line, doing much better than people expected. SL Green was out. You're going to have Renato report on Monday. That's going to likely surprise people to the upside as well. So with the A properties, the best of the best, I think they're really undervalued here, and they're going to be opportunities moving forward when you look out 12 to 18 months. With the B and C, I think you have trouble, and that's going to force the Fed's hand as these loans need to be rolled to be more dovish. So my bet, look, you look at the Fed funds future, it's still at 75-80% odds of a hike next week. That's kind of priced in. They wanted to get to 5.1 on the terminal rate. That would get them there. So I think, you know, you probably see that for sure. But I do think at that point, the surprise might be, and we're going to pause for now and leave rates elevated for some time and see how the market absorbs it. We reserve the right to raise again. But for now, credit conditions have tightened. The labor market has loosened. GDP has come down, you know, which no one was really positioned for. And I think all the, and you've got some more dovish members now with Goolsbee talking some sense after the Fed has basically rammed the truck through the wall and started to break things. You have some voices of reason coming on board and saying, hold on. Let's just take a breather here and see how this works on a lag basis before we absolutely throw the economy off the cliff, which it could be teetering on if they keep pressing.
So like you mentioned, GDP, it came out today, advanced quarter one GDP estimates came out, and it did come down, like you said. Did this change your positioning from an investment standpoint at all?
No, it just pulls forward the pause. So I think prior to this print, you started to see baked in 25 this month, but you also started to see people saying maybe one more coming again in June as things were humming along. I think with this type of print and with some of the initial jobless claims and continuing claims that we've been seeing and the jobs report that we've seen and the headline inflation, tomorrow we get core inflation, which will be the most important data point before next week's meeting. Of course, we'd like to see that come down closer to 4. I mean, maybe even below. You know, the big thing with inflation has been the owner's equivalent rent, which is such a big component of GDP, of CPI, that it's starting to show up, you know, leases on a 12-month basis, on a lag basis from last year's high base effects. Rents are rolling over. You've seen all the data, David, whether it's Zillow rents, Redfin rents. So those are going to start to show up majorly in a major way in May, June, and July, not in time for next week's meeting, but certainly in time for June. So the Fed may be done, and that's going to have broad implications, done meaning a hike and done, broad implications for the investment landscape. Namely, the dollar has been sniffing that out since October. The dollar is down some 13%. That's going to continue. And if they're done, I think you are going to see a regime change where emerging markets are going to start to get bid. They've been left for dead, largely as a function of the strong dollar in the last couple of years. But if that dollar downtrend continues, I do think you're going to see more and more assets flow into emerging markets and the opportunities there on a relative valuation basis, and then obviously on a currency basis. Because if you look at the correlation over the last few decades, when the dollar weakens, emerging market equities rally.
Are you long emerging markets equities then? Is that sort of a short play on the U.S. dollar as well?
We are long emerging markets through one large position that we've had for some time and been adding over the last year, which is a company called Alibaba, which they're breaking it up into 6 parts to unlock the value. This business is, there's not a lot to think about here. You've got a business that's trading at 2014 IPO prices. And in the meantime, they have grown revenues 800%. They've grown cash flow and earnings by 500%. You got smoked with the regulatory overhang and the crackdown and the lockdowns all in 1 year, three 1-in-100-year events all at once. That's changed. And what you're seeing, we're going to see earnings in a handful of weeks. For instance, their e-commerce business is about 50% clothing and apparel. And what we've seen from the producers of a lot of that in China and competitors like VIP shops, et cetera, is that the Q1 numbers are absolutely through the roof. And the estimates embedded in the business are that the trends created by the once in 100-year lockdown events are going to persist in perpetuity. We think this is trading at somewhere around a third of intrinsic value. To give you an idea, they have this business called Preshipo, which investors assigned basically zero value to. It could effectively be the Costco of China. And they're going to be IPOing that piece of the business alone for $10 billion. Most investors had never even heard of it. Then you've got the cloud, you've got the digitization of China happening. The cloud business is going to, as an industry, according to McKinsey, is going to triple by 2025. Alibaba has 36% market share. And what they're doing right now is they're cutting price to grab share because it's the razor blade business. You know, if you think about, they basically give away the razors so that you keep buying the blades where all the margin and where all the money is. And that's exactly what Alibaba is doing right now. As the largest player, they can just crush all their competition. If you look at the web traffic, the traffic to Aliyun.com, which is their website, it's up 89% in the last 30 days, and everyone's pessimistic about Alibaba. It's pessimistic about their earnings. I'm seeing the apparel sales in China. The GDP shot the lights out, causing major banks to have to take up their GDP estimates now from 5% to 6% for this year. And that's going to be a massive growth driver, not only for China and Alibaba, which is the proxy and the toll taker for Chinese growth, but for actually the S&P earnings in the back half. If you think about multinationals and the currency headwinds that they've had for the last 2 years, that's going to help earnings. China's opening is going to help earnings, which is why Europe has dodged a recession that everyone was certain was going to happen 4, 5, 6 months ago. And a lot of good things are happening. But we think not having emerging markets wait at this juncture is going to be cause for underperformance as you look out 12 to 24 months. So that's a position that we've consistently built. Every time it gets weak, we add, and that's going to be a monster over the next 12 to 24 months.
All right, thanks for that. Let's talk about U.S. stocks now. Let's bring it back home. What's your outlook for the stock markets for the remainder of the year? Earnings this week, like we mentioned, a lot of big tech companies beat expectations. Did it surprise your expectations? We've got a confluence of factors going on. For one, the consumer confidence index fell to a 9-month low. Data came out earlier this week. So forward looking, I guess people are feeling less confident about spending, but the earnings surprises to the upside show that the last quarter people were spending a lot of money, except Apple. Or Apple earnings haven't come out yet, but Mac sales dropped 40% in quarter one. And so, putting all these forces together, Thomas, do you think that these earnings strength or the strength in earnings that we're seeing this week can continue into Q2, Q3 and beyond?
Yeah, I think the tech weakness is in the rearview mirror. I think they've taken aggressive action to cut costs. Even with all the cuts that you've seen in tech in Q1, they're barely back to pre-pandemic levels. In other words, they haven't offset all the hiring that they did during COVID. And in many cases, they were hiring these people and putting them in a closet just so their competitors couldn't hire them. I mean, it's comical when you think about it. So considering the amount of weight that the top five or six tech companies are in the S&P 500, and the fact that they've acted quickly, we do think that not only are you going to see them able to sustain these, but actually grow. What was surprising, what everyone feared, was the enterprise spend, software as a service spend, and cloud spend. And Microsoft and Google more or less alleviated those fears. And if anything, not only stopping the level of deceleration, but actually a potential back half reacceleration of the cloud, of software as a service, of enterprise spend. And considering the weights and the earnings power of those companies, even if the regular economy slows, these businesses can carry the day. Plus, you consider 50% of revenues overseas for the aggregate of these bigger companies. With the dollar weakening, that's going to be further juiced. So just as the stock market's a discounting mechanism, as you know, just as the stock market discounted the slowness that we're seeing today 6 to 12 months ago in October and in June with a 25-27% peak to trough decline, I think what you're going to see here as we move into June, you know, we're 6 months out from 2024. Even if S&P estimates of $246 are a little bit high and they come down to 240, or even reaccelerate when you consider the dollar and you consider some of the enterprise spend coming back in, you know, as much as looking at today's earnings, the market feels fully valued, when you look at forward earnings, there is opportunity. And I think this can push higher. I think it can also push higher meaningfully because of positioning. One of the data pieces that we look at extensively, David, is the Bank of America Global Fund Manager Survey, which you probably saw last week for the month of April. You know, you have managers are more overweight bonds relative to stocks than they've been at any point in time since the lows in March of 2009. Those were the great financial crisis lows. So the pessimism is at those levels. You have growth expectations, the lowest that they've been since the March 2009 lows and the pandemic lows. You have risk levels, the amount of risk that managers are taking are at the same levels as the March 2009 lows. And I don't think we're anything like that. And then finally, you have real estate pessimism at the lowest levels they were since the 2009 lows. Now, what was the problem in 2009? It was residential real estate, right? Now, if you had bought residential real estate during that crisis, when pessimism was at its highest point, you would have done quite well buying a lot of residential real estate in March of 2009. This year, the problem is perceived to be commercial real estate. And we look at some of these businesses like Vornado, that is A class, not B and C. We're not touching the B and C stuff, but the A class properties, they are trading at great financial, just above great financial crisis low levels. And, you know, if demand for Park Avenue, Madison Avenue, Fifth Avenue, Sixth Avenue in New York City, the best buildings in the greatest city on the world, goes out of favor, then we have a lot more to worry about than Vornado or Steve Roth, one of the best real estate operators in the history of commercial real estate, betting on the jockey there. So we like these asymmetric opportunities, and we like that managers are so pessimistic, because the markets don't top when managers are overweight bonds and cash. They top when everyone is overweight equities and overweight equities on margin, and there are no marginal buyers. So while there are things to worry about, like the debt ceiling, like the Fed, like the banking crisis, the market is climbing a wall of worry, and the market never creates an opportunity where everyone is in cash. You know, the consensus is everyone is in T-bills. I'll just get paid to wait. And when the market drops 20% more, I'll go in and buy equities. And that's not just sophisticated, quote unquote, sophisticated investors. Go ask your Uber driver if they're in cash or stock. And I can tell you they're all in cash, and they're saying, once it drops to 3,500, I'm going to buy all these stocks. And when that happens, the pain trade is up, and all these people are going to be forced in at new highs, whether that's 6 months, 12 months, or 18 months down the road, they're going to be forced in. And not only have they missed the 17% rally off the October lows, they're going to miss the next 20% upside.
I'm going to come back to that, but let's talk about smart money positioning here. I was reading a note earlier this week. This is from the Commitment of Traders report. And it revealed that I'm just going to read this note, the number of net derivative contracts on the U.S. T-10-year note, so U.S. Treasury 10-year, dropped to a record negative 1.29 million in the week ending April 18th. Hedge funds are increasing their short bets on U.S. Treasuries. This is the largest bear position on U.S. Treasuries in a while on record, actually. So, you know, what's the sentiment right now? Is that a bullish position on equities, or is that just risk on or risk off? Yeah.
No, that's absolutely perfect, as a matter of fact, because large speculators and hedge fund positioning commitment traders is often a contraindicator historically. So what they're all betting on is that the Fed is going to go longer and more aggressively than we think is going to be the case. And if they're, and that's how they're positioned. In other words, bonds down, yields up. They're short bonds. Historically, this has been an acute point where the exact opposite happens. Speaking to your point about commitments of traders, because this is something that we follow very intently, hedge funds are also the shortest they've been for over a decade, going back to 2009 again, in terms of S&P futures, in terms of Russell futures, they're very short, in terms of even Dow futures. So, and usually when they get short, if you want an indicator as to a more predictable indicator, and it depends on instrument by instrument, but you follow the commercial hedgers, and they tend to be early and they tend to be right. Commercial hedgers are getting aggressively long the S&P, aggressively long bonds, which implies a compression in yields, a normalization, and that would actually follow with our bullish thesis, where with rates normalizing, the Fed pausing, the dollar weakening, earnings coming back, and a reacceleration in the back half, which the market is sniffing out, and that would force the market higher and push all these people in cash back into the market at the exact wrong time. So we think a lot of the stars are aligning for the wall of worry to keep, you know, continue to climb the wall of worry. We did get a hair overbought in the short term. We had that move off the lows in March. So we're kind of consolidating here, waiting for direction. And now it looks like pushing back through today after we got through what everyone feared, which was tech earnings. And they came in so much better than expected, and people just simply weren't positioned for it.
So I'm guessing today's rally had more to do with tech earnings than the lower GDP data.
I think unequivocally. I think certainly the lower GDP data, you know, you didn't want a 3% hot number going into a Fed meeting, right? And come through the other side with a 50 basis point hike. That would be devastating for the stock market. But that was kind of already known, David, in that yesterday or the day before, Atlanta GDP now took their Q1 estimates down from 2.5 to, I think, 1.1 or 1.0. So the market kind of knew that, and it was soft in recent days following the First Republic saga that never ends. So no, I think this is a function of earnings. I think this is a function of some of the guidance, some of the rhetoric coming out of managements, and just seeing beats across the board, whether it's the big banks, certainly the smaller banks were a little bit of a weight, tech, some of the industrial companies. I mean, across the board, it's just, even if they're not taking guidance up, they're not taking it down. We didn't have the pre-announcements, which I was talked about quite a few times before the year's earnings season started. I said, I just don't think it's going to be that bad. And you haven't seen any pre-announcements, and we're, you know, banks are going to report in a few days. And that's been the case. They're not taking down the guidance. Some of them aren't taking it up, but they're not taking it down. And that is much better than expected. And as they say, David, the secret to happiness in life is low expectations. And that's certainly what we came into this earnings season with.
I think Warren Buffett had a similar quote about marriage, but that's another topic. Thomas, let's finish up on your expectations for the Fed and then finally market. So how many more rate hikes are we getting this year after next week?
I think that's it. I think it's going to be one and done. I think they're going to get to their terminal rate. What would be beautiful if this thing is still lingering, I mean, if they get First Republic resolved over the weekend, then they might have an impetus to raise and say, we'll see what happens next, you know, see you next month. But if that thing is still lingering and lending at these regionals is contracting, you see it in the numbers, the surprise would be if they said, we hit our terminal rate, we're now at an elevated level, we intend to stay at an elevated level for the foreseeable future, we reserve the right to hike again if inflation resurfaces, but for now we're gonna take a pause and see how this works through the system, as the data is already showing us that things are slowing, both in the labor market is loosening, which was our intent, wages are decelerating, which was our intent, rents are decelerating, which was our intent. So we have you know, mission accomplished and reserved the right to go back to the well. I think the market would be very surprised. And what makes me think that that's a reasonable probability is the way that no one is positioned for it. And that would be maximum pain given the amount of cash and the amount of people in treasuries that would have to scramble up 5, 6, 7%.
Finally, I have to ask you about the big bad R word and how you think that's going to affect your outlook and your positioning. You mentioned you're still long this rally. At what point would you change your bullish sentiment? Recession, would that have anything to do with it? Or perhaps Fed surprise to either direction? Any catalyst for a reversal in your position, Tom?
Yeah, well, I think that the correction of last year priced in a mild recession already. So it would have to be something dramatic, like, and I wouldn't count the Fed out. They've already gone too far in terms of one of their tools, which is interest rate hikes. I've said for a long time, they should have stopped at 3.5% and unwound $400, $500, $600 billion off the balance sheet. And they could have drained liquidity that way and kept rates at a reasonable level and affected the same slowdown, but not locked 80 million millennials out of the housing market when they're just starting family formation. So, we buy businesses. I don't buy the market. I don't bet, is the market going up? Is the market going down? I pay attention to that because it impacts when I enter the businesses. But the businesses that we own have such a margin of safety at the levels that we've purchased them. It would take an awful deep slowdown. And I think, by the way, we already got it last year. We had a technical recession in Q1, Q2. We had the bear market. We had the correction. It's unlikely, if you look back since 1950, to go this long without retesting the lows. It's very low probability that that we go back down. So I think on balance, you can kind of feel it in the economy. Yes, you're seeing a slowdown in numbers and all of that, but on balance, it almost feels like we've had this rolling recession sector by sector for the last kind of, call it since Q1 and Q2 of last year, whether it was tech in the back half of the year. I think you're just getting to the end of the semiconductor recession or depression, which was the pull forward of PCs and servers a couple years ago during COVID, as you referenced, 40% MacBook sales down. I think we may be at peak inventories as it relates to that. It'll be very interesting to see what Intel has to say tonight. It may take them another quarter. Maybe peak inventories is not this quarter. Maybe it's next quarter. But I think we're getting close now. And on that basis, historically, unless the Fed really destroys things, which now they've got cover that they can pause if they want to, I think the more likely outcome is everyone's looking for what can go wrong. I think there are very few things people are looking for what can go right. And there are quite a number of things that are set up that point to a better back half and certainly first half of next year.
Finally, you have an excellent newsletter. Hedge Fund Tips. Everybody should follow that. Tell us about that and where we can follow your work.
Well, thank you. Yes, it's hedgefundtips.com. And you can go on there and put your email in. You'll get our daily newsletter. But more importantly, on a weekly basis, on Thursdays, we put out a research note every week, which has a wide following among institutions, hedge funds, journalists, ultra high net worth, and regular traders and investors. And also on Thursdays, we put out our weekly videocast podcast, which has been going for about 3 years now. I think we're on episode 184 today, and it's actually ranked number one in the hedge fund category by FeedSpot, albeit it's a small niche, but we are number one, and we're proud of that, grateful for that more than anything else. And I think people will get a lot of value if they like that particular style in the market. We Ask Me Anything questions from the audience. We go through different companies. It's all opinion, not advice, of course. And I think people find that very valuable. And that's the feedback we've been receiving consistently.
Yeah, I do have one final question to close off our conversation since you're talking about tips, hedge fund tips. This is more of a tip for the younger audience watching and who want to or aspire to work at a hedge fund after college. What should they do in their early days in school? How should they prepare for this career?
Yeah, I think there are a lot of different ways to get there. The number one thing I would suggest for people who like valuing businesses and investing in companies and buying things at a discount, start to read for the CFA. I think that's the most important thing you can do. If you want to go more the trading route, I don't know the exact route that you would take for that, but I think if you learn about how to value companies, that's going to serve you well in your life, in your career, in getting your foot in the door. And that'll put you probably 5 years ahead just by getting that information all at once versus having to learn it over time. Alternatively, you can go the investment banking route and learn how to do models for 3 years and then either wind up in private equity or in a hedge fund. But either way, you've got to learn the basics. That's table stakes. So I think the CFA is probably a more direct path, or you could go work for an investment bank, but you need some type of training to get in. It's not just, going to your favorite, clothing store or, burger store and say, wow, this is a great business. You know, we should invest in it. It takes a level of analysis, a level of training. And then from there, you just learn from experience over and over, and you work harder than anyone else as an investment in your own future. And if it's appreciated by your current employer, you're going to get more compensation. And if it's not, you're going to get it elsewhere. And that would be my biggest suggestion, is always do more than you're paid for as an investment in your own future. And sooner or later, the compensation will catch up with the work. And more than anything else is compounding that knowledge over time, because that's where the real value is to be had. And that'll set you up for an incredible life. So that's my best tip.
I think that's advice for any career, not just hedge funds. But thank you for that, Thomas. And on that note, we'll end it here. Hedge Fund Tips, follow Thomas at hedgefundtips.com. Thank you for your time today. Appreciate it.
I appreciate it, David. Thank you.
And thank you for watching my channel. Don't forget to subscribe.
And we're back. So I hope that was helpful. Also want to thank Ellen Chang for including me in her article on thestreet.com. Want to thank Manya Saini, Siddharth S., Rejmo George, Apran Varghese for including me in their article on Reuters. Want to thank Saeed Azar, Nupar Anand, Tatiana Butzar, Manya Saini for including me in their article on Reuters a couple of days ago. And Ankika Biswas and Manya Sayani for including me in their other article, as well as Ankika Biswas and Sruthi Shankar for including me in their article on Reuters. And that's that. Shifting gears to Cooper Standard, because we got a lot to cover in a short period of time today. We talked about this last week. We were going to have these continued. You know, we put it out in May and June. Our base is about 550. Newer customers, it's a little higher. Not only did we buy the KRE premium today, we also bought more Cooper Standard. And it was really amazing because we brought in a lot of new clients recently. And we weren't able to size into it because the basis was too high when their money came in. But today we were able to lean in and get them much better positions and bring their basis down. So we're pretty excited about that. And we had talked about a few weeks ago to expect these rallies and then checkbacks and rallies and checkbacks. And we said, you know, I don't know if it has to test 10 or not, but, you know, it probably could. And sure enough, that's what we did today. So maybe it goes a little lower and takes us out, scares some people. But it's going to work higher, and we're going to talk about that. So here's the deck from earnings. The only thing you need to know more than anything else, and we'll go through it all, is that they were free cash flow positive for the 3 months ending March 2023. They have ample liquidity of $250 million. Sales are exploding. Their revenues came in much higher than estimates. I think with $661, they came in at $82.5. They had the loss because of $81 million one-time charge due to the restructuring. You back that out, they've got improvement, and they're getting their costs dramatically under control. So we'll go through a couple of quick points in the earnings call, which was this morning. So this was kind of the wrap-up from Jeffrey Edwards, the CEO. He said, one of the key reasons I'm optimistic is that over the last 4 years, we've significantly leaned out our cost structure. On a cumulative basis, we've taken out $480 million in annual operating costs, and we expect these savings to carry forward into 2023 and beyond. Oh, by the way, now car sales are going up, and they're starting to normalize back to 2017 levels. Not there yet, but moving at a healthy clip. We saw GM, we saw Stellantis, we saw Ford, and we see the numbers, which we'll cover in the article of the week. And the operating leverage is just going to be staggering. So our base case has been we wanted to get to see $6 to $8 of earnings over the next couple of years, 2 to 3 years, as the volume recovers. We're seeing the dealer incentives we anticipated. We're seeing the pent-up demand come back. Despite the slowdown, people have 13.5-year-old cars, and the operating leverage now is going to be staggering for these guys. And plus, they're getting recovery on cost from the OEMs, and it's going to lead to really positive things. Now, keep in mind, as they've done in previous calls, they're still negotiating those contracts with the OEMs, so they can't play it like, hey, business is great, our margins are through the roof. Why? Because the OEMs are having margin compression because they're stuck in that EV business and Elon Musk is squeezing their lunch. By the way, Tesla is a customer of Cooper Standard as well. So we really don't care. We're agnostic to whose business does great. All we care about is the industry volumes go up and Cooper's going to participate because they're the best in class in what they do. Ceilings, fuel delivery systems, cooling systems, etc. They make more money per EVs than they do for ICEs, which is exciting. They do more parts at higher margins. So as all these people want to lose money selling EVs, Cooper Standard will be there to make a ton of money and watch them do it. So he talks about the cost. He talks about the efficiencies. He talks about another reason for optimism is enhanced commercial agreements that we've established with our customers over the past year. We are better positioned to now manage through the commodity cost fluctuations than we have ever been before. So what that's code for, without tipping their hat to the OEMs, is we're going to have as the volumes turn, our margins are going to be higher than they were in 2017. With the majority of our key commodity inputs now under index-based agreements, our customers will share a greater portion of any further impacts from commodity inflation. In addition, we are working with our customers to adjust pricing to cover other elements of cost inflation that are beyond our control. Second phase of cost recovery initiative is still underway, but we have made great progress. As I said in my opening comments, our customers have recognized the value we provided them over the years, evidenced by numerous awards they've given us, and they've been supportive both in terms of awarding us new business as well as in terms of price concessions where necessary, et cetera. Customer award class, anticipated top vehicle programs. Okay. On an unweighted basis, our content per vehicle across these top 10 platforms is expected to be approximately $200 this year. I'd also note for the first time, an electric vehicle has made our top 10 list, turning to slide 20. So we can see some of these decks, 17, 18, 19, 20. That doesn't sync up with the deck I have. But nonetheless, cash flow positive, revenues growing. And by the way, Q1 of last year, Q2 and Q3 were easy. Q1 was actually a tough comp that they blew the doors off. So that's pretty exciting to see. 613, same period last year, 682 million, 682.5 million this year. So everything's moving in the right direction. The key was they got that refinancing done. How they did it, I don't know. Well, I do know they paid $81 million of fees to get it done, which is unbelievable. Fees and one-time costs. But they got it done, and that's the name of the game moving forward, because the whole thesis has been operating leverage and industry volumes normalizing, and both of those things are happening. So by the grace of God, we had one last opportunity to get our newer clients in at a decent basis, and we took advantage of it, and maybe we'll get some trickle on in coming days. We'd be grateful for that too, but we're happy to see that. Next, post-great financial crisis bottom. This is from Seth Golden. Equal weight outperformed cap weight 28 months post-COVID bottom. Equal weight outperformed cap weight in 2011. Four banks failed, breath failed, yields declined. In 2023, four banks failed, breath failed, yields declined. Human behavior repeating. I like this because this is equal weight relative to the S&P. What the bears have been saying is, oh, don't trust this because it's just a handful of stocks leading the rally. But that's actually very common coming out of a heart attack like you had in 2009. You get this rally, and then you get decline of breath before the next leg higher, before it takes a breath. And we're seeing the exact same thing right now, the exact same story. And that was the time, if you were buying stocks in September and October of 2011, you made a fortune. And I think we're in a similar situation, certainly with selective ones that we've been buying, and excited to see that. So kudos to Seth for putting out this analog on Twitter. This is a breath thrust indicator that George put out this week. You can see the video that I recorded a few years ago. It just shows that when this signals as it did in April or late March, that good things happen for the following few years consistently, and that's over 50 years. So there's no recency bias embedded for all the skeptics out there. This consistently works over time, and it marks major bottoms as we saw in March and April. So very positive to see that moving along. GM Ford posted strong numbers. We covered that. Intel tops Wall Street estimates. CEO says data center business is improving. That wasn't the case with AMD, which means they're taking back share. We're excited to see that. Lisa Su is going to, she's running an incredible business. I'm not going to give her a hard time, but maybe we can catch up and give her some competition in the coming years. We'll leave it at that. China celebrates economic recovery, pledges more help on jobs, so they're going to stay in the market stimulating. China's customers lead recovery in April. These numbers are through the roof. We covered them in Twitter and some of our last week in detail on the retail and everything else. Macau casino revenue jumps again in April on China tourism boom. We've been talking about that for a year. It's now playing out. China property government likely to keep market support coming as April home sales tank. They're spending money on goods. They're not spending money on houses. People always avoid the problem of the last crisis. No one bought houses in 2009 when they should have been buying houses. They bought other stuff, and it's the same in China. They're buying handbags and clothing and trips and all that stuff, but they're not buying houses. So the government's going to keep the pedal to the metal. China's AI industry barely slowed by U.S. chip export rules. People were worried about, won't this hurt Alibaba's cloud? And the answer is no, because data server chips are basic. Their AI add-ons are more advanced, but they have some level of that, and they have made some breakthroughs. It might not be as good as AWS, but they don't compete with AWS in China. All they need to do is be the best in China, and they'll continue to grow share, and that's exactly what they're doing. Here is an article from the New York Times. In China, it's time to splurge again, and the luxury industry is relieved. The end of the pandemic era restrictions has unleashed a luxury spending rebound in China. So that's more stuff that we anticipated that's playing out. This is an interesting article. Here's when history says the post-Fed pause rally should start and two unlikely sectors to benefit. Cliff's Notes version, after the last cut, it takes 2 weeks for the market to bottom out and then it starts to rally. So we're only one day into it. Market has to digest it and understand what it means and probably take care of some of this banking stuff in hopefully coming days, if not coming weeks. Alipay and WeChat data shows China consumer spending over May holidays exceeded pre-COVID levels. Digital accounts account for more than 90% of the mobile payments market in China. By the way, a total of 274 million people went on trips within the mainland during the holiday, 19% more than the same period in 2019, 19% more than pre-pandemic levels. That's all you need to know. It's been open for 16 weeks and it's already exceeding pre-pandemic levels. Article of the week, tell me you're pausing without telling me you're pausing stock market. So here's a picture of Jay Powell with the pause button. On Wednesday, Chairman Powell bumbled his way through another sell-off, par for the course, as he holds the record for worst market performance following his communications. He's the worst communicator, empirically, probably in the history of the Fed. Ahead of his 43rd Fed day, Chair Powell has so far seen the worst stock market performance of any Fed chairman from the 2 p.m. Eastern time release through the close. Kudos to Bespoke, who put this out before he spoke, and it proved to be right. To a man with a hammer, everything looks like a nail. Powell is single-mindedly focused on lagging inflation data. He fiddles at the altar while Rome burns. More banks will follow the liquidation path with no clear cap on funding costs and no enhanced deposit insurance plan. I expect that will probably change sooner than later, but it may not. So, you know, we're not taking outsized bets, certainly not on any individual regional bank. We did do a punt today on the KRE index with some long-dated deep-in-the-money options that we can make many multiples of our money with a very, very small risk over the next year if this plays out as anticipated. Probably a little more pain before that starts to work. But you see here some gaps in the Dow from Thursday, so we'll probably go down and fill that if we haven't already today. I haven't looked at the intraday. just this second. Same thing with the QQ, the NASDAQ, same thing with the S&P. So looks like about 40, 45 on the S&P would be the gap fill. Covered that with the two segments you already listened to. But among the statements I found completely out of touch with reality was the FOMC release that began with the following assertion, quote, "The U.S. banking system is sound and resilient. Tell that to the thousands of employees, equity holders, debt holders of the four large banks that have failed in the last few months. And more importantly than anything else, tell it to all the policemen and firefighters who are invested in pensions with their 401ks that owned a ton of these high-quality regional banks that are now getting smoked." So economic activity expanded at a modest pace is what they said. And they said, quote, "The U.S. banking system is sound and resilient." That is just, that's scary because you lose all credibility. It's like when the sky is, you know, blue and you keep saying it's black, you know, people stop listening to you after a while. And I think that's what the Fed has done. They painted themselves into a corner and they're going to have an awful long, difficult time unless there's a change of leadership soon. So does this look like a sound and resilient banking system that you want to kick in the teeth when it's down? Well, here it is at February. The KRE was at 64. Today it got down to 35 and change, which I know because we put on that options trade. So we'll see how that plays out. This is not just four little bank failures, Silvergate, Silicon Valley, First Republic. These are three out of the top four biggest bank failures in history. And the Fed is acting like nothing's happening. And it's kind of a joke, but they're actually the joke, which is sad because now they'll have to do something abnormal and they'll have to intervene and it will wind up costing the taxpayer more money down the road, either explicitly or implicitly in the form of higher money supply. Charles Payne put this out. Market value of regional banks has plunged to $100 billion from $480 billion since January of 2022. Will Powell twist the knife today? Well, he certainly did yesterday. Now someone else is going to have to clean up his mess, just like Mnuchin had to clean up his mess in December 2018 when the stock market fell 20-25% in a matter of weeks. And on Christmas Eve, Powell had to call the five biggest banks to come together, provide the liquidity, and backstop the market. And then they forced Powell to go out the next few days and change his position a complete 180 degree. And they let him keep his job, which is also beyond me, but it is what it is. Here are the statement changes from the last Fed meeting to Wednesday's Fed meeting. The big statement was, the big change was, the shift in determining the extent to which additional policy firming may be appropriate versus the committee anticipates additional firming policy may be appropriate. And he did say that the statement change was meaningful. So he's trying to say, without saying it, tell me you're pausing without pausing, that that is not just a couple of words, that's a complete regime change, i.e. we're pausing. But I think at this point he needs to stop being so coy because the market is uncomfortable with the consequences of increasing the funding cost for banks, that they can't compete with treasuries and money markets. And then on top of that, people don't want to put their money with them because they're afraid they're going to be wiped out. So they've got to solve those two problems. Anyway, I also found this statement odd where Powell says, "The staff predicted a mild recession in general. However, my forecast is for modest growth, not a recession." I mean, this is mind-boggling. He's got 200 some odd PhDs working in the building, analyzing data. And he says, "Oh, that's fine. Those 200, you know, they're going through all this. But I don't think we're going to have a recession." So he's one guy. I mean, they must have two different data terminals in the building because I can't reconcile this. And somehow he's doing it. But it wasn't all bad news. Fed omitted the prior language that signaled more hikes ahead. He acknowledged that was meaningful. Then his whisperer at the Wall Street Journal, Tim Araos, came out and said the FOMC statement used language broadly similar to how officials concluded their interest rate increases in 2006, with no explicit promise of a pause by retaining a bias to tightening. And then Powell said more data will be required. I hope it's not the same data that they're using that to get two different projections, but nonetheless, more quote-unquote data will be required before we can declare we've reached a sufficiently restrictive stance. So on the one hand, he says one thing. Out of the other side of his mouth, he says something else. And then he says, we feel like we are close or maybe even there. And then he said that in the video, so you can listen and judge for yourself. It's a new language. If you understand people who speak out of both sides of their mouth, you will understand exactly what he is saying. I find it confusing from time to time, to be honest, but I know what he'll be ultimately forced to do regardless of what he thinks or feels or projects. I could care less about those three things. Ultimately, this waffling will wind up being more inflationary than explicitly pausing. More banks will fail in coming weeks, and the FDIC insurance fund will likely be drained as no one steps up to buy the underwater assets. The balance sheet will be re-expanded back to record levels as they try to keep the toothpaste in the tube with holes on both sides. It is a restrictive versus proactive stance that will ultimately be more costly than doing the right thing right now, but it will probably work. It'll just be more costly. So here's the latest bank Deadpool for those of you who watched the movie with Ryan Reynolds. Hopefully Powell and other policymakers wake up before too many get kicked off the list. So far, they are not hearing the message of the markets. They're tone deaf. First Republic's already off. This is from Monday. This is Richard Wallen. He's a really good credit and bank analyst. He's been around for decades. He's often on Fox and CNBC. And he said, so next on the bank failure list sorted by beta, he owns Western Alliance. He said, Powell may not make it to Friday. I guess we'll find out. I wonder what would be more bullish for the markets, backstopping deposits or replacing the Fed share? I think they'd both be about equivalent, to be honest with you. Maybe that's the cheaper way to do it. You don't have to backstop the deposits with hundreds of billions of dollars of FDIC insurance. Maybe just replace the leadership and get someone who can communicate and instill confidence versus confusion. That would be helpful. But since I find people who identify problems without offering solutions relatively intolerable, I don't want to be that person here. I'm going to reiterate two solutions I've been repeating since the mini banking crisis began. Number one, the executive branch has the authority to act in times of emergency. They could instantaneously enact a temporary deposit backstop for 12 to 24 months until things cool down and Congress can formally pass legislation to increase the insurance cap. Currently, 45% of U.S. deposits are still uninsured. Number two, the Fed needs to explicitly pause, not cut, in their Fed speak parade in coming days and weeks. Remember, the blackout period is over, so you're going to see all these guys on TV, hopefully not contradicting one another as they usually do, but actually speaking in unison. This will stop, slow the bank funding cost acceleration and deposit flight competition with money markets and treasuries. If the Fed wants to continue to drain liquidity and battle inflation, which we're not against, by the way, do it through slow, methodical balance sheet reduction, selling the bonds on the balance sheet, not more hikes. You got close to a $9 trillion balance sheet, take that down a few hundred million, and maybe at the same time, cut rates. I'm certainly okay with the pause. I think the economy can handle it. But maybe if they took $1 trillion off the balance sheet and brought rates back down to 4.5 or 4 and let millennials, 80 million people who are trying to start families actually buy houses, that would be a good thing, not a bad thing. So until one or both of these actions are taken, keep your eye on the Deadpool. The outcome will not be like 2008 because they will pump mass liquidity into the system and expand the balance sheet to record levels. But it is not the prudent, proactive way to deal with the situation, and it will ultimately be more inflationary and directly or indirectly more costly to taxpayers. Everyone knows this, but for now, they remain like an ostrich with their head in the sand, hoping and praying the wind goes away by itself. It can't and it won't, as the genie is out of the bottle. Only proper and swift action can put her back in. Constructive. So with all that mouthful out of the way, we remain constructive. Why? Well, Presley, who cuts all of my media appearances and posts them on social media, came up with this excerpt from the David Lynn report on Wednesday. Presley is a college student, and he has a better feel for the markets than most, if not all, members of the FOMC. And here's what he thought was important today. And the clip was why we're not worried about our core positions. I don't know if you'll be able to hear this, but I'm going to play it. And if not, you can just play it in the article of the week. No, you won't be able to hear it. But it was basically saying we don't really care about the short-term fluctuations of the business. The core positions we own, we bought with such a large margin of safety that it's embedded. You know, these type of situations are embedded. The business is going to continue to improve, and that's the key. So do go ahead and listen to that at the website when you get a chance, because it's an important clip that he singled out. The other thing that I wanted to actually play, which I forgot, was from my Chinese friend Jack Zhang, who sent me this video from on the ground in China. This is what shopping looked like this week, which is just mind-boggling. Let's show it to you here. Okay, hold on for a second. Okay, so there you go. It looks like Times Square on New Year's Eve. And what he's saying here, this is a live video taken in the City Commercial Center in China during the May 1st holiday. Most crowded they have seen in 3 years. Businesses are making money hand over fist. So that literally looks like Times Square on New Year's Eve. Why? Because I'm a few blocks away at Bryant Park, and this is what it looks like on New Year's Eve, even though I don't walk down there on December 31st. You know what's going on. This is mind-boggling. Look, not a mask in sight. It's like COVID never happened. And that's what the numbers are going to start to reflect, by the way. Like COVID never happened. Pretty. Oh, there was one mask. Sorry. Out of the hundreds. Just at the end, of course, there was one mask. Okay. Cooper Standard reported after the bell. Revenues blew away estimates, coming in at 682 versus 663. This compares to 613 for the same period last year. Gross profit was up 94%. The adjusted EBITDA was positive 12.5, and they were cash flow positive, and they've guided that they're going to be cash flow positive for the year, which means the liquidity is not an issue, even though they've got $284 million worth, which is good to see. The adjusted loss was an improvement, and certainly the EBITDA was an improvement from $100,000 last year to $12.5 million this year. The sales were just off the charts. Foreign exchange hurt them. As the dollar weakens, that's going to help them. But what you're seeing, the U.S. sales were up huge, 43 million, so 321 to 365. Europe was up big time, almost 20%. More than 20%, 131 to 161. South America, Asia was the only drag, but that's going to be China, which is going to be a big deal moving forward, which is good to see. China car sales continued. This is full Asia Pacific, so that was weaker than expected. But that is that's the smallest market for them besides South America. Key is this North America and Europe number, but predominantly North America because that's where all the profits are. This is from Robert Burgess over at Bloomberg. It says, wow, car sales roared in April, coming in at 15.91 million annual rate seasonally adjusted, which is the most since May 2021, and topping the consensus estimate of 15.1. So this is big deal, ladies and gentlemen. I mean, if you look how despondent things were, even last spring when we got in May, June, it was down at a 13, less than 13, 12 and change. It's already up to 15.91 run rate. And you get back to 2017 levels, you got to be at 17. So we're, more than 65% of the way there, and then all the margins will start to flow. So this is really good news. Vornado reported on Monday the stock trades with regional banks, so expect more volatility until the next few banks fail and they finally take proper actions on deposits and or Fed speak, but nothing changes on the thesis. And if anything, I found Steve Roth's assertion on the conference call that he was, quote, going on offense, very predictable. He didn't become the best in the business by being unprepared when opportunity strikes. He's ready, strong, and opportunistic regarding what lies ahead. Here are some of the highlights from the call. First and foremost, he said, we are full speed ahead with current projects, total over 5 million square feet in the Penn District. Newspapers and industry tabloids that say we have stopped is incorrect and just plain silly. Just take a look at our 3 blocks long construction site when you go through Penn Station, or the next time you go to a Knicks playoff game. You can't go to Rangers playoff games anymore. Because why? Because the Devils whoop their butts. That's why. Now, some commentary on last week's dividend press release and reaction there too. Simply stated, we're going on offense. And then he says, let me say that again. We're going on offense. few facts for context. So he basically says, all right, I'll read the whole thing. In 2022, our dividend was 212 or $435 million in cash. Over the past 10 years, we paid $5.1 billion in dividends and another $400 million in special dividends last week. Okay, so they paid out $75 million this year. They're going to pause paying dividends in the second and third quarters, and in the fourth quarter, based upon known facts, actual taxable income, including asset sales, etc., they'll pay out, as we must, taxable income, which they have to in REITs, but they're going to assess whether it's wise to pay in cash or in a combination of cash and scrip. Shareholders should be indifferent as to whether they receive cash or scrip, but that cash, if retained by the corporation, might be more wisely employed for debt management, stock buybacks, or whatever. Skipping forward, seeing the value in the stock and an opportunity to create shareholder value, last Wednesday, we included in our dividend press release, our board authorized a $200 million share buyback program. So this basically means if you own the stock, you're going to increase your ownership by 7% over the next year without putting any more cash out of your pocket. So forget about stock price. Just think about the buildings. If you could own 7% more of the buildings than you own right now, of all these buildings, top A-class buildings, the Penn Development, Park Avenue, Madison Avenue, 6th Avenue, 5th Avenue, etc., without any additional cash out of your pocket, is that a good thing or a bad thing? Or you could take the cash and pay a ton of taxes, but I think that's a bad thing to do in this time and environment, because the only other time the stock had been this low is the great financial crisis, and you want them buying on your behalf if you've already positioned yourself. If you haven't positioned yourself, then you can, you know, do that as well. But taxable income is currently projected to be 1.05 without any asset sales, and surely there will be asset sales. Couple comments. We think we have seen the peak in work from home. More and more CEOs are now requiring their employees to get back to the office. Sounds familiar. We've been talking about this for a couple weeks. With each passing week, the office buildings feel more like 2019, and we believe it's just a matter of time before everyone is back for good. New York City seems to be leading the country in this regard. I agree unequivocally. Every time I go, it's busier and busier and busier. This is very important. We have $2.2 billion of liquidity, including $1.3 billion of cash and treasury bills. We have over $8 billion at today's markdown values, of debt-free, unencumbered assets. Penn 1, Penn 2, and Farley are unencumbered. The remaining capital program to complete Penn 2 has been pre-funded and will be paid for out of cash balances. These buildings have significant future embedded earnings growth, and as Penn 2 rents up, that incremental income will do wonders for our debt metrics. We have relied primarily on project-level non-recourse debt. Old-fashioned mortgages, only 2.5% of our debt is recourse, and that with well-laddered maturities. We are clear-eyed and realistic about the near-term financial market challenges. We will certainly have a few workouts to deal with, but over the next couple of... But that is the point of having non-recourse debt. What is that code for, ladies and gentlemen? If they have a building that the bank won't work at, they're just going to mail them the keys and say, take it. If there's no equity in the building, have at it. So basically they say to the banks, you renew us on favorable terms, or here, you can have the keys. We don't care. It doesn't affect the rest of our buildings. And if there's no equity, why would we want to hold it anyway? Have at it, you know, back to the bank. So only 2.5% of our debt is recourse. Okay, we covered that. But that is the point of having non-recourse debt. We have no maturities this year. Limited property level maturities next year, by the way, limited property level maturities, that's non-recourse. They can give them back the building, worst case scenario, but the banks don't want the buildings, so they're going to do good deals. It's called extend and pretend. They do it every single crisis. This time will be no different. And no corporate maturities until 2025 with sufficient capacity on our line that matures December 27th. So they've got no non-recourse that's not covered by other credit lines. And it's not even an issue till 2025, but they've got the liquidity till 2027. So if you think this is going to go for 4 years, maybe you would start to worry a little bit. We don't have that view. So Okay, so we don't have to reach asset finance at current in the current hostile market. So, okay, now the thing that blew my mind was that they're getting rents above market and above last year and above $100 a foot in some of their buildings, which is just mind-boggling. I remember looking on Madison Avenue like 10 years ago at $43 a foot. And it's mind-boggling. Anyway, so our company-wide same-store cash net operating income for the first quarter increased by 1.5%. Our core office and retail businesses remain resilient with long-term credit leases. Leasing activity has been led by strong demand from traditional industries, financial services, and law firms in particular, with many financial firms growing their footprint and accounting for 40% of the 7.4 million square feet leased in the first quarter. The availability of new constructed properties has substantially declined, with much of the new trophy space now largely absorbed at a record level rents. Increasing tenants in the market are increasingly focused on the highest quality, redeveloped Class A buildings that are near transportation in Midtown and on the West Side, which is resulting in rents moving up in these buildings, which Vornado controls those markets. Our office portfolio is filled with these types of buildings. We completed 22 leases totaling 777,000 square feet with a healthy metrics, including starting rents of $101 per square foot and a positive mark-to-market of 1.7% cash and 8.5% cap. This included our full building 585,000 square foot deal with Citadel at 350 Park Avenue and 82,000 square feet at Penn One at $92 starting rents. If we exclude the Citadel deal from our statistics, our team completed 20. Citadel is Ken Griffith, by the way, for those of you who don't know, one of the largest hedge funds in the world. Our team completed 21 leases totaling 192,000. By the way, the reason Ken Griffith is going to New York is not because he likes taxes or liberal governments, because he moved his headquarters from Chicago to Florida. The reason he's going to New York is the reason every financial services and law firm goes to New York. If you want the best talent, that's where you need to be. And if you want the best talent, you better be in the best buildings, because someone who graduated from Harvard or Columbia or Princeton last year is not going to go work in a C building in ABC City unless they're doing social work. So that's all you need to know. So now in the high 90s and breaching $100 square foot and towers, activity is picking up with Penn 2 as well now. Overall, we have very good activity in many of our assets, generally at higher rents than a year ago. Our leasing pipeline in New York remains healthy. We have more than 400,000 square feet of leases in negotiation, plus an additional 1.4 million square feet. The financial sector in particular continues to be active. And you see here subway traffic in New York now at 70% of 2009 levels, whereas San Francisco is at 47%. Alibaba continues to fill out its pattern to shake out the final weak hands ahead of earnings later this month. Many of you won't make it through the volatility and will throw in the towel at the exact wrong time. It's simply the way the market works. So we've covered this. Just like the S&P has not made any progress in 2 years, not only 12 months, but 24 months, Baba has done the exact same thing, the exact same price in, you know, the last 13 months now. But it's following the normal pattern. You have this massive cascade down, then you have these fake outs, then you have the final flush lows, then you rebuild, then you shake people out, and then you make your final big move up when you let no one in. And this aversion period here is when you get the last people out. And I would expect, just because this is such a beautiful pattern, probably something like this: flush them down to the low 70s and absolutely get rid of all these weak, whiny sisters, and then take it straight up based on intrinsic value. Now, we covered many underlying statistics on clothing sales and cloud traffic in last week's podcast videocast, which gives us optimism coming into the earnings call later this month. Based on the weakness, fear, and whining I'm seeing on Twitter and hearing from commentators, a nice overthrow into the 70s, like we saw in March of 2022, right there, should break the back of the final weak hands before we accelerate higher following earnings. Better to get them all out now rather than having deadweight sellers who have no idea what they own trying to, quote, get out at their basis. I want to sell it where I bought it on the way up. So we got some additional data this morning. Holiday spending increased 200% over the same period in 2022, 70% over the same period in 2019, according to Alipay's May Day Consumption Insight. So you can see that there. The tourism was cited by People's Daily up 162% from the same period last year. 159 million trips were made by car, rail, airplane, waterways in the first 3 days of the five-day holiday. So that data continues to improve, and rising tourism revenue, it's back above 2019 levels. So that's that. I added the following commentary to this post. We talked about the Costco of China, which is Freshippo, which people assign zero value to, is now preparing an IPO at a $10 billion valuation. The thing that people don't understand, this is just one of many parts that are currently assigned zero value. And as it breaks up and they do spin outs and IPOs that will continue to hold a part of through the parent, and then eventually get the other stock, is that this is just one example. If you consider Costco has 851 stores after 47 years, Freshippo has 300 stores in 27 cities after 8 years, okay? So Freshippo aims to have 1 billion consumers doing about $145 billion in U.S. sales nationwide within the next decade. It took Costco 47 years to hit $234 billion in sales. Costco's market cap's currently $220 billion, which is down from a peak. Freshippo's at $10 billion. So, you know, even if they hit a third of their goal, it's still going to be worth $70 billion. And if they actually do more, which we think they will, it could ultimately be worth, you know, $150 billion. And right now it's worth zero. So that's just one piece. That wasn't even in the thesis when we got involved in the business. In the thesis was Ant, was AliCloud was the biggest part of it. And that continues to be the biggest part of it. Oh, and by the way, Taobao and Tmall happens to be one of the greatest businesses, which we're going to see in earnings at the end of this month. So the most common cause of low prices is pessimism, sometimes pervasive, sometimes specific to a company or industry, or in this case, country. We want to do business in such environment, not because we like pessimism, but because we like the prices it produces. It's optimism that is the enemy of the rational buyer, and that's from Warren Buffett. Chinese stocks are heavily discounted. Prices are low relative to expected profit growth, and you can see it here relative to forward levels. Trading at under 8 times EBIT relative to the S&P trading at 14 times. So that's all you need to know. Price is what you pay, value is what you get. As Munger says, he can get more value for lower cost investing outside the US and namely in China when he was asked about it at the Daily Journal meeting. U.S. Ambassador to China, Byrne, says U.S. is ready to talk to China. This was earlier this week. It got caught up in the bank mix. U.S. Ambassador to China says we need better channels of communication with the Chinese. How about the telephone? Let's start there. Earnings. Earnings are coming in better than expected, and estimates are starting to revise upward. We've been talking about this. 53% of the S&P reported, 79% beat on the top line, 74% on the, 79% on the bottom line, 74% on the top line. Earnings were expected to drop 6.3%. They're down only 3.7%. The industries that are crushing it is consumer discretionary. If you remember in Q4, I was saying no one wants consumer discretionary. And they're doing much better than expected, as well as communication services. We're expected to be negative 14. They're negative 11. Consumer discretionary was expected to be plus 33. They're plus 47. S&P was expected to be negative 6.7, they're saying, and I guess that was as of March 1st. Now they're at negative 3.7. Other names we've covered of late in our podcast, video cast, and on media and TV appearances have been performing very well in recent weeks, so there are no updates we need to cover at present. I'm kind of the opposite. Most people, they cover their winners. I cover the losers. Baxter's working great. That thing's been straight up. Intel, XBI is now finally getting bid with biotech. SWK, Generac, Amazon, Google, Disney. We spend our time fixing temporary problems, not patting ourselves on the back talking winners. Other factors. Here's from Seth again. Goldman Sachs said it's taken a while, but ding dong, the retail investor is dead. Retail investors have sold twice what they had bought during the pandemic. Capitulation? Question mark. I think he answered his own question. The retail investors are absolutely flushed out, and that's what you need to take the next leg higher. And I think once they get some resolution on this banking thing, which could be imminently, we think, we don't know, but or it could not happen. They, you know, they're well capable of screwing things up as well. But usually the pain becomes so acute, they take action. And don't sell in Maine, go away. In the 95 years since the start of the S&P, S&P has risen 65% of the time between May and October and 70% of the time since 1990. If this is the final Fed rate hike, that doesn't have to be a bad thing. On average, 12 months later, the market is up 14.3%. The median is 16.1%. That's from Ryan Dietrich over at Carson. And stocks have gained 90% of the time, 9 out of the last 10 years, in the month of May. So selling May and going away may not prove to be as profitable as expected. Retail, as we know, is flushed out, 24% bullish. No change from last week, but the bearishness jumped to almost 45%. Sign of capitulation as well. Fear and greed is neutral, and the active managers got flushed last week down to 50%. Moving right along, biotech earnings, this is the cap weighted, down by 2.49% in the last 60 days, 1.3% for next year. The equal weighted, which is the XBI, down 1.3% for this year, but up 1.88% for next year, which is big because this is the equal weighted, so you don't have the skew as much. So that's positive to see. As we said, estimates continue to go up. This looks a whole lot like 15, 16, and 17, where you had that choppiness, and then you took off on the tax thing, 2001 to 2003, that choppiness, and then maybe we take off on, you know, could be the bank resolution, could be the debt resolution, could be the Russia resolution, could be anything, but no one's positioned for anything good, and I think these earnings are going to prove to hold up better than people expect, and they're actually going the other way up, and the bears don't know what to think about it, other than to say, no, they have to keep coming down while they keep going up. So we're positive on that. Economic data. Manufacturing was an expansion, but right at the edge. ISM manufacturing, PMI, prices. What was the big thing I wanted to cover here? Car sales, I think, came out. Yeah. In April, we're 15.9 million compared to 14.84 million. So they're continue to jump up. Truck sales are jumping, car sales are jumping, and total vehicle sales are jumping. That's a big deal. Non-manufacturing still in expansion, but a little weaker. So the Fed likes to see that. Although continuing jobless claims came in better than expected, and initial jobless claims also jumped. So that's something also the Fed wants to see. We'll see the jobs report tomorrow as well. Maybe that will cement the pause becoming possible, the becoming for sure, or their parade of talking will do the trick next week. Average hourly earnings. Okay, so that comes out next week. Moving right along onto the questions. It's rock and roll. Got to get to the airport. Ron Amchin. Thoughts on Sigma Lithium. According to their presentation, they're expecting cash flows equal to their market cap in just 2 years. Also likely will be sold based on CEO comments. I don't really like those type of projections. That sounds like a big pump and dump to me, but let's just see what's going on here. I don't like these commodity plays. They never seem to work other than like short-term trades. They tend to be pump and dumps. But now everyone's into EV and the lithium is the Bitcoin of today. Let's just see what it looks like here. All right, so this stock has gone from $7 to $40, and now you're interested in taking a look. You know, that's not an ideal situation. It's not to say it can't go higher, but let's just see if there's anything to all the hype. Okay, so this is Brazil. That might be a double way to play the weaker dollar, so that's kind of interesting. This is a pure spec play. They're saying we have the stuff. They're not selling anything, as far as I can see here from the income statement. No, they're just losing money and promising the dream. So pass for me. I mean, maybe it works, but that's just a gamble, red or black. Go to your casino. At least you get a free drink. Stephen Clark, thank you for your weekly podcast. Absolutely enjoying all the macro insights and stock analysis. As a BABA shareholder, wondering if the split six separate entities may be dilutive for us if we have invested in the U.S. ADRs. Do you suppose the subsidiaries preparing to IPO in Hong Kong market will issue new shares dilutive or sell existing shares non-dilutive? In either case, assuming that the... Well, they're going to sell new shares to raise capital at current at a valuation that is probably higher than the valuation today. So it'll be anti-dilutive based on your current price. Plus, it will foster growth because you'll have access to more capital, to more growth, to more runway. Okay, in either case, assuming USA ADR is a shares of the holding company, would they theoretically encapsulate the market cap of all public companies? Look, they haven't given any guidance. Some are going to be IPOs. Some are going to be spinoff. But the idea behind this, and Daniel Zhang gets it because he worked with Jack Ma for so long, is to unlock shareholder value. That is the purpose of it. So, and the amount of stock that they give out to themselves, they're not going to want to dilute themselves either. Management does have quite a bit of stock. So I think this is to be determined. The key is that whether they break it up into six or they don't break it up into six, usually when they break it up, you're going to get a lot more value because each of them can grow on their own, raise capital on their own. The ones that are losing money don't drag on the ones that are making money and vice versa. So I think it's going to be much more accretive. And in terms of the aggregate value, could be much more than our initial projections when we started talking about Alibaba. So we're very constructive on that. It just has to play out in its due course, and it will. Brady, I wanted your opinion, not advice, on Generac. Similar situation 3M. I purchased Generac at $95. Its all-time high was $498. I'm sure it's at least a double, but do you think its fundamentals could lead it back to the $300 or $400 a share? We own this, full disclosure. It's a newer position from last month when a lot of new money came in. So last month meaning mid-March. So yeah, it's up a bit. You know, had good earnings. $300 or $400, I don't know. I mean, it's a play on housing. So if there's a lot of new housing, which we expect there will, if rates start to come back down, then this thing's going to be an absolute home run because they have a moat in their business. They do have a little competition, but it's at least a double, and then we'll see what the numbers look like from there. So good work, and we're on the same team. John Wolak, new listener from David Lynn interview on YouTube. Welcome. I saw you answered questions on your own YouTube channel that I'm now following. I'd like to know what you think of New York Community Bank. I'm up 73% on in the money options purchased recently. John W. John W. This is from April 30th, Sunday. So let's take a look. NYCB. Personally, I wouldn't be in any individual name, which is why we played it how we played it. I just wouldn't. You know, we've covered in recent weeks that we wouldn't buy any individual banks. That's why we actually finally bought the basket today, because they got completely flushed. And I liked it right after the debacle from yesterday. Maybe we'll get a few more chances to buy it in coming days as they dither around trying to figure out how to do the deposit insurance and or dovish talk. But, you know, in a normal, this is a confidence environment. So as good of a bank as New York Community Bank has been for decades, so was First Republic. And until you have some security around funding costs, meaning they don't keep raising rates and banks having to compete with money markets and treasuries, and that's number one. And number two, deposits, and you don't see all the uninsured deposits. My guess is, and I'm trying to remember off the top of my head from the matrix that I have, I think New York Community Bank has a smaller number of uninsured deposits, but you have to look that up. I personally wouldn't play any individuals. Congratulations on the punt, but not for me. I think it's binary, and I think you have no edge until the government does something, and you can't game when the government's going to do something. So you just have to, you know, you can look at things on Twitter from reporters who maybe have an edge, but nothing's happened. I mean, that's an old tweet, so we'll see. JP, thoughts on Playboy, PLBY? It's currently trading below liquidation value. Not a great business currently, but maybe possible turnaround. That's too cheap to ignore. I don't know. I mean, I think that's like Victoria's Secrets was, you know, it's just not the environment for it. Let's see. Yeah, from 63 down to 1. So let's take a look at the cash flow statement. I'm going to, no matter how good these numbers look, I'm not interested, but let me just see if there's, it could be a cigar butt where there's one more puff left. PLBY, but it's not a good sustainable business. All right, so they just keep losing more and more money. Revenues are going up. Why are revenues going up? I mean, maybe they got into a different business. This is a no for me. They're burning cash, irrespective of revenues going up. They probably did a crappy acquisition and overpaid for it just to pretend they were doing something, kind of a Hail Mary pass, which is what a lot of CEOs do to keep their job for another 12 months and milk the company. But let's just see. I don't know how to analyze this. It's, you know, Playboy.com, HoneyBurdette.com, Yandy.com, LoversStores.com. I, you know, this is not my expertise. I'm just a pass on it. Good question. Paul Gertz, hope all is well. Thanks for the video cast. You were the man. I've read, thank you. Read the Intelligent Investor, all Buffett's partnership letters, still working on Buffett's Berkshire letters. Plan to read security analysis next, but I'm not sure which version to choose. Have you read a particular version you liked? I know Buffett says the second edition. I think Michael Burry recommends the third edition. Just wanted to get your opinion. I don't know which edition I have. I would go with the Buffett one, the second edition. Don't overthink it. It hasn't changed much. The only thing that's going to really change is the intro, but the principles are timeless, and that's the name of the game, and congratulations on taking those steps. Drew Byrne, hey, Tom, hope all is well. Given the current more favorable evaluation, grateful if you could comment on how Comstock's potential going forward, where a reasonable upside target could be after 2 to 5 years. I find energy stocks tricky to evaluate. Comstock, you know, range was easy. We know what the intrinsic value is there. Comstock is a different game. You're betting on the jockey, Jerry Jones. So if range does what I think it's going to do and go above 60 over the next few years and beyond, Comstock will probably have a similar type of move and trade in concert as they did in the early 2000s. And I think we're in a similar environment when it comes to natural gas and energy. So, you know, range has made a huge move, obviously, and that's been a great one for us. But I think it's still got some more to go in terms of intrinsic value. And I think Comstock could be a similar story. I'd have to look at it closer, but I think you could probably see a similar situation where it's in the 40s or 50s. It's a little harder to analyze because of the deal that they did when Jerry got involved and everything else. But those are the two. Comstock's pretty small for us. Range is still a nice size for us. That's the way I'd play the energy. If you had to be in a lot of energy, I still think that it would need to get, the group would have to get a lot lower for me to get really interested again. And that's why we only have 2 natural gas plays on for exposure. Ron, thoughts on Despegar, a South American online travel agency nearing their COVID lows. Businesses mostly recovered and grown throughout the lockdown period. Management's guided 80 to 100 million EBITDA for 2023 and 130 for 2024. 360 market cap. All right, let's take a look. DESP. It's a new business. I don't like these new businesses that haven't worked through cycles. So for me, it's a pass, but let me just see if it's a... I need to see how management operates through all types of cycles. I just, you know, this is principle like one in two out of Ben Graham's The Intelligent Investor. You want stable, predictable cash flows. This is a new situation. I mean, they're still losing money. So, no, this is two strikes. I like the thesis. I like the narrative. I like all that. I don't like the fact that they're losing cash consistently. I don't really care about EBITDA as much as I care about cash, unless it's something that has like monster this has never been a quality business since they started. I mean, they can't generate a return for equity or on invested capital. It's not for me. If they can't do it in a good environment in 2019, they're not going to do it now. So for me, that's a pass. That doesn't mean it won't work as a trade, but if you want to own a business and grow with it, it's, you know, again, local casinos are better. At least they give you free drinks. So with that said, we'll see you next week. Same time, same place. In the meantime, make it a great one. Bye for now.